Blog Talk Radio.
Found Masonic Effects. Absolutely. Good to have you sit in with us again. Well, I don't know what you're sipping, but I hope you're making yourself comfortable and you have a bit of time, whether you're hands on the wheel, you know, tearing down the highway, or sitting back in your favorite chair in the middle of the night, sipping something. If it's morning, you have a cappuccino. If it's afternoon, or you'll have a nice civilized espresso going, and I hope you have something interesting in front of you satisfy what's happening. This is we live in some strange times. I don't know how to just skirt through to have a talk with thinking people, with Masons, people who are not prone to proselytizing. But are prone to the big attempt to understand and know who they are as people and their values. So, you know, asking those very courageous questions of us about how we know ourselves to be just people and such, and also attempting to understand the world around us. It's that convergence, you know. I don't even think I could ever say it anyway. It's the beauty of this, to think of the artistic form and when you hear about the, you know, exquisite and the simple formula that, you know, that you strive for. We have wonderful formula, mathematical formula, but some are just exquisite. Well, you know, that's inspiring for some, inspiring for others. They look at us wide-eyed and shake their head and have no idea what we're talking about or what we're thinking about. That's life around us. Who in the right mind is going to go around saying, "Oh, look at if you." You need to prepare. Well, when I hear that, I think of the fellow standing on the soapbox with a big sign: "The end is coming. Prepare." You know, with some kind of threat. You know, I have to find a theological resolution for angst because there's this perceived threat. Well, man, you know, I don't buy any of that stuff, really. You know, it's like the world. I like to think of the world that we live in is a garden. It has some sectors of it are jungle, and some of it is risky. And we need to be aware. And we need to teach our children. Okay, we can wrap them up in bubble wrap and hide them away. I suppose we see people doing that in different ways. You know, those cults that are producing the handmaidens. You know, that kind of stuff. Margaret Atwood, how do we clairvoyant? But hide away and pretend, or we can do what those thoughtful parents do. Not us, but, you know, what those thoughtful parents, those intelligent parents do. They're not driving the biggest car. Those people are sensible. Where do they... And they seem to be quite content, and they always seem to be able to find a way of entertaining themselves, and they never seem to get impatient. They have some time. They're learning or reading, and what are they, weird? They actually enjoy reading? What in the world? What's happened? They'll call a good Saturday with the family is going to the art gallery. What is happening? And they play musical instruments. They enjoy, or they'll sit and listen to the classical music and jazz and country, and they don't seem to, and they explore. What is wrong with them? What is wrong with them, huh? Those are the folks that I think are you know, not prone to thinking about the growing fear. We teach. We learned a long time ago that teaching about the risk is smart. That's a way of embracing the sense that the fates are always with us. We, you know, blah blah blah. We never know what tomorrow's going to bring. But what's the context of the comment? It's like, so I have other things that are more important than doubting my sense of tomorrow. But you go ahead. No, that's what turns your crank. You go ahead, but screaming at me? Nah, I'm not real prone to. You know, I don't really learn that way. That's not, doesn't really rock my world. Or threatening me? No, that doesn't. On the other hand, sitting down and talking, you know, explaining something so I can think it through, so I can reason. Well, then maybe we have a connection, you know. It was like the feeling I had when I went and saw whales in a whale tank. I thought, this is just, you know, you pay a ticket, pay a price, and keep these things in it. This is not right. This is just wrong. Polar bears doing things for little bits of marshmallow. This is wrong. There's just, yeah. There's thinking it through, right? And then notice how the value, if you notice, do you impose values? Well, there's some places where some things make sense and other places where they don't. And the wiser among us can sort that out and notice. But is this walking around labeling people? I hear that, you know, it's wrong to label. I don't know that, but you say that. How do we talk about things if we can't? We can clean it up, and if there's implications about the terminology we use, well, we can be very, very selective about it. We can be aware of it. If we know that something that we're doing causes offense to other people. Now, I know what you're going to say. Everybody likes to take a run at the dominant group, you know, especially if you're old and male and white. Oh my, you know what I'm saying? You're the fault. You're that part of that empire building Britain. You're the insular looking Russian Empire. You're all of that. And you have that legacy to go with you, and you haven't really changed. Well, I know we can have that history, and the insensitive amongst us will continue to say, like a president not long ago was crowing about this being a modern crusade. What is, you know, what doesn't go through the minds of some people? But you see the point. We have got to this point where, yes, there are consequences, and yes, we are living through them, and yes, we are finding new evidence. And you and I make that a qualifier for truths. And yes, it is unpleasant at times. And yes, people that were downtrodden and subjected to this exploitation have found their voice and found rights and are looking to share. And we know that. It doesn't detract from the discomfort. And nobody necessarily wants to look for that. I don't think people that are finding their progress or are making strides are wake up in the morning wanting to cause hurt and anguish for people. But it's a toxic blend of guilt. I mean, who amongst us can live with that? Well, we know we compartmentalize that. We institutionalize guilt. And at times we bring ourselves collectively together to feel it and experience it so that it doesn't become more corrosive than it already is. The deeds, how do we compensate? Well, that's the mystery question, isn't it? That's the mystery question. For a lot of you out there, I think the answers lie in making this kind of conversation the most remote. In other words, there are more finding, more satisfying, more rewarding, more riveting, more penetrating topics to work with. These ideas, the horrors or the grotesqueness of the past begin gradually to take a different place in a life. At the time, if you are at the bottom of the guillotine and it's your turn and you've heard the sound, you don't need to have a lot of time to sort out what's coming next, do you? But there comes a time when the relatives and the bystanders, great-grandchildren, no longer have that image carefully planted in their mind, right front and center. It's there. It just moves. It doesn't disappear. The guilt, the reanalysis of the imperialism, for example, it takes a different place in the periphery of the mind, but doesn't go away. No, it doesn't go away. It's always there. What we do with it, and I think this is the speaking to the audience that I'm with here, what we do is we learn from it. We try, and I say try because we constantly need to understand. For the likes of us, we can commit acts of contrition, and the difficulty is assuming that privacy and that we do this anonymously or quietly, personally. Maybe it is the gesture when we see somebody protesting, when we see somebody's anger, taking a moment to speak with them seriously. And I know. So when somebody is being rash and just being quite unpleasant, it takes time and a bit of self-discipline to listen, to continue to listen. And that's where we seem to be at in many, many ways, going from the rage to the absorption, the exchange of the information in a meaningful way. The rage is the rage. And I'm not declaring that rage doesn't have a purpose or it isn't communicating something important. I am saying that we need a firmer consequence, a more meaningful consequence, than a more nuanced conversation. And we do that not as escapism. I don't think that you or I or any man who look beyond the racial barriers and religious barriers and political stripes. We are not looking at barriers, but similarity. We are gathering in information, and it is awareness. But when you think about it, it should be things that are factual. Is there a theory of fair play? is there a theory of the fates of being rash? Is there a theory of immaturity? And now I guess an interesting question is, are we always defined by our collective history? Well, I think not, because I think we are the way we live is different than the way it was 300 years ago. And I think our values have been impacted by the things that have happened to us in that period of time. It's not that we've been living in a vacuum. Things are going on. We move from something toward, and along that way, we in Masonry, we've taken what was thought of, and I think sort of, I don't know, we're told repeatedly that we're on this journey, but my goodness, I feel better if you tell me I'm taking a trip. Then it feels like I'm participating in it. It's not the burden. Oh, the journey just seems, oh, yeah. Let's get this over with. But then somebody, whether it was Hermes or Hiram, one of those guys, you know, whispers in your ear, you know, there's a way to absorb more about what's going on around you. Did you ever think about that? And the question is, why ever would I do that? Well, let's back up on that. Let's talk about the nature of our thinking. What channel, what lane are we in as we approach this? Are we skeptical? Well, okay. Do we realize that and moderate it? Because we need a degree of skepticism that allows us to not be jumping at the first finding. Here it is. That's the answer. The skepticism says, is that all the answer? Can we do this answer? Can we recreate this answer? Is it consistent? Is it just one-off, you know, opinion? That's perfectly legitimate, but we don't call those facts. The whisperers out there not only said that we can live differently than we are. They were talking not so much about a gold ring. They were talking more about our potential, our inward potential. And that's something that tweaks a tremendous curiosity to think. Are we, no, even how we think of that, are we going to exploit it for some benefit? Well, you little determinist, you, what benefit did you have in mind? You're going to make some extra money? Is that what consumes you? Because you have this sense that that's what's right, and that's the only thing important? Really? Well, I'm glad you've made that judgment for us. There is some alternate, there is some other realities out there that help us determine what's important and what's not. Masonry's, the whisperers are telling us and talking to us, and I think are suggesting that we pay attention to the important bits, the bits that are exceptional, and let the other stuff go. That the pettiness and the all of that immaturity, let it go. Doesn't serve a purpose. And so the focus, the Stoics might remind us that focusing on things that make us feel anxious is an absolute waste. It's not productive. And just tell us, don't do it. Don't think that way. Well, do you remember the first time you had that notion, somebody coming on and saying, don't think that way? Well, that's easy. How no? Immediately, isn't it? How do I do that? How do I keep all that negative stuff? What is it negative? I wasn't aware, and it's affecting me. Well, negative stuff affects me negatively. I wasn't aware. And how do I just stop thinking about it? Well, isn't that so Masonic? Isn't it? You need to figure it out, don't you? It's not easy. It's the complexity of what we're doing. Is it any wonder where I am that where some practices, some versions of Masonry are no longer have the weight they once did. Is it any wonder that others are finding value, and they're connecting with a small core, a relatively small cohort, who have around the world had these tunnels and channels to one another, and they have been carrying forward the value of Masonic principles and beliefs. But that may well be. I'm inclined to think that there is. I don't find it vulgar or unappealing for somebody to say, you know, you need to be able to work. Well, duh. It's not that you remember going through life as a Freemason is a matter of a memory. No. It's a matter of revisiting these values, revisiting the landmarks, and bringing them up so that they stay alive and vibrant and in our frame of reference. So we do that by talking. And when we don't have that opportunity or we're tired of the chatter, we do that by reading or watching something. Now we have screens that allow us to do all of this stuff, but ostensibly we're still left with that notion of reading. Where do you, if you were brought up in a generation where the written word is now a keyboard principle, by all means, you know what I'm talking about. It's the same process of expression, capturing it and expressing it. And the reason we express it is so that we can share it with ourselves later on, or pass it on and compare it, and other people can help us sort. Now, sorting all of this out, Masonry is doing well in that respect. In that respect, Masonry's on top of this, ahead of it in many, many ways, philosophically. And we'll get into that conversation later here, whether we were talking about the physical side of life or the metaphysical side of life. In other words, do we have one pillar in our lodge or two? Here, don't listen to me. Listen to some music. It'll put you in a reflective frame of mind, and we can carry on. We can press on. Thanks for sitting in. My goodness, it's an absolute pleasure. Thank you. Spanish professor I've told you about, spoken about before, Joan Chamorro. Interesting guy. And those are some of his students. He blends them in with professional musicians. Kind of interesting project that he's on. I needed to have a word with you about the future. I was thinking of that at the time when I came up with this title for the commentary today, Unimaginable Immortality. I don't certainly think of myself as immortal in any way. I am what I am, and when I'm gone, I'm gone. And I'm not so much thinking about longevity here as influence. If we can help to influence somebody to live a better life, or to strive and find some satisfaction, to make their payments through life beneficial, so that they can give knowingly and give freely where it's needed, where they can have a sense of compassion and altruism and care for the people around, a sensitivity for it. And whether they think that they need to keep their liberalism under wraps until they get to the center of all the power, and then they're going to make the change. Well, no, that doesn't happen. But keep that sentiment going, because you know you're suppressing a lot of things in order to convince yourself, to rationalize and convince yourself that that's how you move forward. Today, I live in a world where people are asking questions about the ethics of investment. Is my portfolio full of oil and gas exploration or blood diamonds? You know, I want to know, and no, I don't want to be making profit, and you're going to lose my business if I find that out. If you're using child labor to produce that bespoke shirt, I'm not going to buy it, and I'm going to expose you for what you are and who you are. If you're exploiting young ingenues because you have you're in a position of being able to encourage careers, you're going to be identified. There should be no safe place for you. And if you're a murderous lot that thinks that your wealth shields you, well, nah. Somewhere around the time, nobody escapes this. Nobody. There is a reckoning. And the reckoning is not that complicated. You maintain a sense of your sense of dignity and a sense of loyalty to your two values. And so here, sit back and think, see what you if I made the point about immortality, some sense of continuity. See if I filled in the conversation for you. If ever there was an argument about pettiness, it is continuous in masonry. The argument about it: tend to the things that are essential, tend to them carefully. The rest, they are of little consequence. They are the things that become duties of a good man searching for meaning, searching through the blur. It has been said, as we learn history, that those records are absorbed into our own history. If given the choice of an aesthetic might turn down a meal at a Michelin restaurant. A starving man would consider more than his hunger. So what happens to a puerile sense of right and wrong? As it happens, ritual hints at this very question by bringing forward Aristotle, Plato, Seneca, Pythagoras, Solomon, and even every mathematician who ever lived. There are elements defining a community that exists in the mind, of a community hidden from sight, but the hustle bustle of the marketplace. The ink is still wet on the work of Spinoza and Kant. The epistemology of a child born in 1711. David Hume was yet to come out, but it was impactful when he did. So did philosophy or mathematics or geometry stop developing? Did history arbitrarily stop teaching after the 18th century? Obviously not. When you teach me the significance of Euclid, I have that as an influence in my own work. Masonry opens the doors for us, audaciously aiming our thinking at arts and sciences. By doing so, it becomes possible to influence belief by discovery. Trust your senses. But then the question is sorting out what information I'm taking in without blurring them with ideology. Do your own research. Find your own conclusions, but do so with the advantage of a well-informed cohort. It is the least that a good man deserves. Living as a man of virtue is a lonely existence. It is inconsistent with the hoi polloi. It's thinking beyond the canon of uninformed. That, for some, that would seem so unachievable and perhaps even an elitist idea. If we accept a single barrier, we are defeated. A single barrier in our pursuits. Don't do that because you'll raise the ire, you'll be concerned. The need to be careful, though, because there are people who present risk. So be careful, be discreet. Yeah. It is repudiation and acceptance of a why not sensibility that compels many of us forward. A well-informed Mason knows things. And when you do that, you know you're going to be a threat to somebody. I don't mean necessarily the knowledge keepers. You know, we're not going to be comparing us yet to the knowledge keeper of a druid. Yeah. The Romans couldn't tolerate that, so they had to eradicate them. But still, the worship of these fundamentals, when people began to pick up the druids are all gone. But that idea of accumulated knowledge is intriguing. And we have today a practitioner, people practicing druidism. And they can be mocked, oh, well, you know, you're making it up. Aren't we all? Aren't we all? Putting the pieces together to make sense and doing it best we can. Thank you. just seems to fit. It's the kind of music that just seems to fit. That's Yoko Miwa Trio live at Regatta Bar. I haven't played her music before. It's interesting. It's interesting to come back to it. Eh? Speaking of interesting, for those of us who are prone to encourage, you know, the detail, you notice things, right? You walk around and you notice things. And who's to say what that is? And what I notice certainly is not going to put blinkers on you or vice versa. But what's interesting is when you share, when we get a chance to talk, as brethren have done for a very, very long time, we knew we would have this opportunity and we search it out. And when it's not there, we find, you know, it's kind of disappointing, but we move on. We say, well, that's on a given day, you know. But we have that we have that notion of conviviality. We expect it. This is about attention to the details. And it's about lifestyle. I've been in places where it's just so understated that it's tedious, it's uncomfortable, where people put in the least amount of work and effort because that's what they were brought up to believe, the least. And in other places, it's an occasion where you're putting in the most. And somewhere in between are the rest of us. And I think that the least is a statement of evaluation. And I think the most is a statement of imagination, where we are making our gatherings special occasions, where there's something significant about them, and there it's done with awareness. Yeah. So I'm going to talk about, again, I speak repeatedly about this whole culture that's been with humanity for hundreds of years, and I suspect longer than that. The songs of troubadours and the words of the ancients and their poems that they used to recite to people about history. It's, in some cultures, it's still quite profound that history is taught that way with recitation. We're talking about poetry and poems, and I was brought up where this was considered not something that a man would ever entertain. That this was considered, I mean, believe it or not, it was considered effeminate. It was like cooking. It was considered effeminate. The greatest chefs in the world, some of the greatest poets in the world happened to be men, but this was the thinking at the time, and it took a re-education to undo it, to pull the plug out of that stuff. And you make up your own, at a certain point, you make up your own sense. Is there something here? Is there something to it? Well, my notion is this is an attention to detail that starts to instill a way of thinking that's quite comfortable. It's not, I'm going to be troubled. What I'm seeing isn't really there. It's more, what you see is limited by your perception. Look at the physics of it, or look at the chemistry of it, look at what's going on around us, and that sense of continuities, you know, this big, long spectrums and us being part of that, you know, that really runs in the face of us being the superior to all of it. We are in command of all that we see, all the land, all the plants, all the animals. Well, my goodness, went upside down. This is a fellow who was part of that Oxford group with W.H. Auden. And we spoke with him last week. This was a guy that was influenced by Auden. Now, I'll leave that too. Auden was an interesting cat, but you're not going to find it interesting because I say so. You have to take a look yourself. But these guys were undergraduates together. And this guy's, they hung around with C. Day Lewis and the like, you know, Lewis McNeice and those kind of writers. This is a guy, Stephen Spender, Sir Stephen Harold Spender. He was born in 1909 in London, and he was a poet and critic. You use those skills when you're looking at details. Of course, you're going to see information that you can relate to. And he was made his reputation in the 30s, and he was making poems expressing the politically conscious, stricken leftist period. Mm. Because what to do? You see these things going on, and in some ways, I find myself going through the same mental gymnastics today. What to do? You know, there's some troubling things happening and ways of thinking that have no good outcome. So Spencer's best known for his perceptive criticism. It's not like somebody screaming. It's more like somebody saying to you, do you notice? It's like the critic of your finest work. Do you notice how, if you did that, this would happen? But done in that kind of encouraging, peer-related kind of way. And then you rebut, you talk back, I haven't tried that, or I have, or this is what I was going for. Hmm. 1983, this guy, Spender, was made a knight. And he brought a highly publicized plagiarism suit against the novelist David Levitt. The latter was accused of having borrowed material from Spender's autobiography for his novel While England Sleeps. Not good for him. And it became controversial and what have you. But here, this is his poem called The Truly Great. And I think this is kind of timely. I hope you agree. He discusses the traits of heroes who have passed away before us. Who does that kind of thing? Hmm? He has artistically developed a sort of reminiscent piece in his writing, which he elaborately glorifies the doings and particularly the traits of these historical figures that have passed before us, leaving a lasting mark on the world. I think of this as a more noble way of speaking about young men being, I was just thinking about a battle in Newfoundland, troop that died or almost wiped out 800 men, always wiped out in one day, July 1st. They were left with 64 people made it after the battle. Just monuments for that kind of thing. And it's breathtaking for me. To end, it humanizes me to let me know that I can still relate and I can have a feeling and a sense of that. And when I look at the monument, this beautiful moose monument, the stag, it's just, this is a three stanza, a bit of work. And he begins with an opening statement saying he thinks often of those individuals who have made a big difference in the world. Good thought, huh? But he refers to these folks as the truly great. And this is fairly straightforward. And then he describes them, and the way he does it isn't so blunt. He describes these truly great people as those who remembered the soul's history from the womb. Mm-hmm. This could hold a lot of meaning. The first and most obvious is in which the word soul can be taken as symbolism to represent people. Of all people have one thing in common, which is a soul. Spender went on to say that these truly great people are those who literally always kept in mind the history of people. So he's taking the idea of soldier sideways, of hero and battle sideways, by forever remembering what humankind had gone through from the beginning of time. In other words, you're elevating the value of a single person through corridors of light where the hours are suns here. So look at I'm going to share with you the metaphors here. See what you think. Short, three stanzas. I think continually of those who were truly great, who from the tomb, from the womb, remembered the soul's history. Through corridors of light where the hours are suns, endless and singing, whose lovely ambition was that their lips, still touched with fire, should tell of the spirit, clothed from head to foot in song, and who hoarded from the spring branches the desires falling across their bodies like blossoms. What is precious is never to forget the essential delight of the blood drawn from ageless springs, breaking through rocks and worlds before our earth, never to deny its pleasure in the morning simple light, nor its grave evening demand for love, never to allow gradually the traffic to smother with noise and fog the flowering of the spirit. Near the snow, near the sun in the highest fields, we see these names are fetid by the waving grass and by the streamers of the white cloud and whispers of wind in the listening sky, the names of those who in their lives fought for life, who wore in their hearts the fire's center. Born of the sun, they traveled a short while toward the sun and left the vivid air signed with their honor. Interesting, eh? You look at nature and you think about this as a tribute to heroes, to great people, the truly great. I guess it's a pause worth considering. And life isn't cheap. Thank you. Django Reinhardt. Django Reinhardt. It's interesting. We're tucking into history. And I think by this look back, this is only, we're looking back 1800s, but as we, 18th century. But as we look back here, it becomes more meaningful if we begin to see patterns with what's happening around us today. And the engagement. Are we a brotherhood of people well informed and engaged, or are we, you know, trying to put our head in the sand and pretend that the ugliness and chaos isn't happening, or we don't have a part to play? I think life is more complicated than that. And collectively, nobody is going to say we're putting our head in the sand. Far from it. You can say we seem a confused lot, or you can say we seem to be a group that has a wide expression of practice. And if we're all searching for questions, we're searching for answers. We are wrestling with the questions. And we have more than one way. There's diversity, and we see great strength in that diversity. And because of that, at a high level of abstraction, we see similarity because we are skeptical. We are probing. We're going to ask the questions. And we aren't always going to understand what we find. But the process, that cauldron of discovery, is still going on. We're still feeding it that's our eternal flame that hasn't gone out. It may be faltering. It's flickering. Where I am, it's flickering, but it's not going out because it's being fueled by other sources, and those other sources are picking us up. They're picking us up to feel, if I was to feel discouraged about a minor setback or some pettiness, I would think it's doing a discredit to all of these other branches of the order, all involved in their own form of practices too. And some of them may overlap, and some of them may be quite similar, and some of them are going to be quite unique, but they bring their own history and their own perspective to the discussion. And here we're talking about nationalism. That's quite prevalent today, isn't it? We're back looking at the time. These people were looking back at recent history, 1756, and what was going on. So when we hear about the decisions of Le Bien Ami and the Grand Lodge in the Netherlands, remember, it's important to remember that the backdrop was war. Yeah, not one, but a series. So they went from, you know, being very, very threatened by, in the mid-1750s, there was a tremendous threat of French invasion. And by 1756, they had a collapse. They had been part of an alliance with Britain and Austria, but it collapsed. 1756, just within 6 years. Things happen, and that collapse is the background for the what they call the diplomatic revolution of 1756, and that brought out the realignment of Austria with its old enemy France. War makes strange bedfellows, huh? With regard to international alliances, the Republic was now adrift. That's the Netherlands. In opposition, increasingly, nationalist voices could now be heard to speak of the Vaderland in terms of its corruption and decay. We can see vestiges of that today where I am and where you are. The decision to establish a national Grand Lodge reflects a growing sense of national identity. And we see in de Grain's insistence that we are, in quotes, a great power, just as the decision may also reflect a loosening of the ties to the British alliance. This is not to suggest that in 1756, Dutch Freemasonry lost its generally orangist complexion, you know, anti-Catholic orangist. But orangism, especially in mid-century, could also be strongly nationalist. Sort of the, you know, all that proselytizing and the whole notion of Catholicism, you know, the literal term of the meaning of the word, had pushback. So there were boundaries. Now, there were elements within the fraternity that were less than eager to bow to the authorities in The Hague, you know, that sense of a central. I think of this, well, there's Grand Lodge and then there's the old lodges of Scotland, and bowing to a central authority, even now it's tenuous, even now, where you want to carry on and say jurisdiction, it's qualified jurisdiction. It's not a one-sided, we're going to tell you how this is going to play out. No, it's qualified, it's careful, and it's respectful. The antagonism of the Amsterdam brothers may reflect the historic tensions between Amsterdam and The Hague, but more likely it also signals a disillusionment with the neutralism on the part of Schroeder and Rousset and their brothers. There's no less. See, how do you deal with this? Well, let's duck. We don't have any skin in this fight, so we're going to remain neutral. Well, brethren with a nationalist mentality would not settle for that, would they? Neither do they today, even to say we don't have those opinions. We don't talk about them in Lodge, thank goodness, my goodness. But we do carry those opinions with us. And it, being aware of them allows us to separate. It allows us to preserve that notion of the sanctum sanctorum in the midst of all of this kind of outside world penetration. But unlike the more elite lodges, it had been doing this, you know, since 1754. And La Bien-Aimée's dedication to what it called a pure English type of Freemasonry may also signal its concern over the foreign, noticeably French influences found in other lodges, especially in the high society of The Hague. So what the author is illustrating here is that being at war with France or being under threat of France did not exactly make one cordial in terms of Masonic influence. And the nationalists, in hindsight, we see people with a nationalist sentiment were seeing that, and that may have been filtering through into decisions about direction. Are we going to cozy up to The Hague or not? Well, we can see it's like saying the independence of or interdependence of lodges and grand lodges have consequences and have sequence of events before that. The Grand Lodge agreed, but was careful given its pro-British sentiments. The orders dwelt upon the meaning of republicanism, both in ancient Rome and in their own Masonic system. And when in 1782, Le Bien-Aimé proposed that the Grand Lodge conclude its alliance with the lodges of North America, now declared independent by the Republic, conclude its alliance. So, and they did. And that's why in 1783, Le Bien was also welcomed a brother from Philadelphia and congratulated him on his newly won freedom. You see, they hadn't been aligned. Eh? From early in the history, Le Bien-Aimé assumed a posture of opposition. See? It's not a reflection of the organization, but of that relationship, that need for independence, where the Grand Lodge was saying, no more, we're going to cut off our connections with the North American Freemasonry. This lodge is saying, no, we're not so keen on that nationalist stance because of the implications. By the way, we have more of a sense of our own republic, and we connect with this fellow. So in the next, we're going to get into the separation of trying to separate Le Bien-Aimé's rebelliousness toward the Grand Lodge from the profound disfavor into which Rousset de Missy had fallen in 1749. So we'll get We'll get there. Now, is there parallels? Well, my goodness, I guess it really is. Depends what you read and what lane you're in your thinking. Do we just, old men get tired of this. Some old men find it penetrating and riveting, and some old men find that the ideas come together and they can weigh, and having developed a sense of the rhetoric, they can weigh and understand the opposition's point of view, because they can put themselves in that person's shoes. They can think of the world through the eyes of another person, rhetoric. And so people that don't know the work, I have one fellow who continues to try and convince me that he doesn't care a lick about what other people say, but he puts himself in those positions. Anyway, we'll get to this and we'll come back to it soon. Here, Cedar Walton. We've reached that point in the program again. I know you're busy. I know your lives are busy and you're active wherever you might be, and you're pushing forward. And I hope we've given you a reason to be feeling entertained and appreciated. I hope we've been able to show a degree of respect for the work of masonry. It's emerging. I have this sense that it is entering a state of becoming. I'm going to say it at the end of a program, and I think that's terribly unfair. This is liminal existence. Can you dig it? Around the world, listeners, thank you for sitting and pulling in a moment, and we'll be back with you in a week. I hope you're in the south, where you're heading into winter, or you're into winter, that you're doing well, and that you can from time to time rise above what's happening around us, and we can think that we can realize that if we're going to make if Freemasons can't come together on philosophically broad brush topics, how realistic is it to think that the world is going to be, the world governments are going to be able to do this with regards to an existential crisis? And I'm speaking here of the environment. It's changing. It doesn't really matter now what is contributed, but it's changing, and we've predicted this. Our scientists have predicted this for a long time. You didn't need Nostradamus to enlisted in this. We've known the facts have been there and the calculations have been made. What to do about it? The risk is we just go hammer and tong at each other, and it becomes another excuse for turmoil. So if we're a parallel and it's a struggle for us, What's to say that the profane world is going to have a greater opportunity, a greater chance of success? I think what it says is that more and more the people of value are going to be more are going to be necessary. The influence. They speak about ethics as if they matter. I hope I get to see you, and we'll sit in again soon, and I hope we've been informative and entertaining. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.